Welcome to another day at the World Debate Institute.
Today's panel
deals with the subject of the psychology of winning. Is everybody interested in winning?
Yeah.
Is that the only thing the debate's about?
Yeah.
Some people are saying yes, some are saying no, and that's what it's all about. Let's meet our panelists for today's discussion, four of the most successful debaters and judges you will ever find. They know what it takes to win. Paul Hayes, one of the most dominant debaters in his last year of debate, winning eight of ten tournaments he attended, and stopped debating with a year of eligibility left. Jan Houghton survived coaching mishaps early in her career to become a winner and the coach of winners and one of America's finest judges. She knows what it takes to get the W. Mark West has been twice seated national champion, and he knows what it takes to win because in those days, the judging was really, really bad.
Half the time, it was really bad.
Glenn Frappier from Gonzaga is not only an outstanding coach, but is a former CETA national champion. They have some words about winning. Please welcome our panel with a big round of applause. The winners!
If you were given some talking points, those are questions you can look at that might help you design some questions. You don't have to ask these questions, and of course they don't even have to answer these questions. But it's just to give you a starting point for the discussion. I'm going to ask each of the panelists for a minute or less just to define what winning is, and then it's an open seminar for questions from the audience.
Could we make sure to just repeat the questions you get from the audience before you answer them so that our viewers out across the globe can hear them?
Well,
suckers, you ought to be
fine with winning. Define what winning is to you.
What it means to me? Well, I mean, I think it's a subjective term. I think it depends on the person. I think that for some people, winning is improving their critical thinking skills. It's deriving the educational benefits of activity. I think that this panel, the winning means winning rounds, but being a winner or being successful, I think that that's again relative. I think for teams with certain levels of experience, breaking is winning. For other teams, nothing less than winning the tournament is winning. I don't think you can have a single definition, and I think that's incredibly important to remember because ultimately, I believe that as a debater, to improve, you need to set goals for yourself, and you need to set realistic goals, goals that you can achieve, but goals that challenge you. Thus, I think that a very important step to becoming a winner is first defining what winning is for you, a definition that makes sense based on who you are as a debater and as a person.
I think winning changes, the definition of winning changes, like Bruce Paul's first objective, for example, if you're about ready to hit Sparacino next year with whoever he's debating with, and you're a fairly young debater, your definition of winning in that round might be just debating the round through, or it might be finishing the round, holding your own. It may not be actually getting the W in that debate. It might be in a certain circumstance that winning is perhaps beating your rival team you haven't been able to beat all year, and you really want to beat them so badly in that round, and maybe winning is actually picking up the ballot in that debate. Maybe winning in some circumstances might be just that you got your research assignment done and you did it right and your coach is really happy with you. So I think winning is a very subjective term, and it's all about setting what your goals are and deciding for each individual round where your goals are. Because the thing about debate is that it's such a huge activity and there's so much involved in it that if your goal is to be a good debater and you start out over here and you want to get over here, that you're not going to get here unless you set a series of small goals in between, because it's too much to do at once and it's too frustrating because you feel like you're never going to reach your goal. And so each win should be when you accomplish that small goal that you set for yourself along the way. And maybe if this round, I'm going to have better word economy. Ooh, I had better word economy. I was winning that round. Maybe I didn't pick up the ballot, but I improved the skill that I need to do to ultimately get to this goal that I want over here.
So winning, specifically in the context of the psychology of winning, which is what I was thinking about this morning before I came to this lecture, there's a quote from the often quoted former New York Yankees player and manager that comes to mind for me. I think he also had a cartoon named Yogi Berra. He said that, referring to his game, it's 90% mental and the other half physical. And I think that the mental part is really where the winning resides. And it's not so much the W or the L at the bottom of the ballot, but I operationalize it as being in the zone. And sometimes when you're in the zone, you end up losing, and that's okay once in a while. But being in that special place where you feel like the game is at another level, where you feel like you're kind of astrally projecting while you're debating and watching yourself debate, being in that zone, that's winning. And in this hour, we can talk about ways to get into that zone. There's a bunch of concrete steps.
So I guess, and I think they go and laugh on that question is pretty bad, because I certainly share all the sentiments they do, but I'll also throw a little quote out there. It's the one that Mark didn't quite get to. Winning isn't everything, or winning isn't the only thing. Winning isn't everything, it's the only thing, okay? That's what I'm trying to say here. You spent a lot of time getting ready for this activity. You spent a ton of time preparing. You sacrificed your social life. Some of you sacrificed your academic life in order to compete in this activity. You're going to lose. I mean, I don't know why you would do this. I certainly wouldn't have done it. I think the most important thing you just heard that for me to maybe talk about real quick again is this idea of setting goals for yourself. Because that kind of does eventually get you to the final goal of where you want to be. You know, coming out of high school, or in high school, my goal was pretty much just to clear, you know, be competitive as much as I can, but I didn't set any really big goals for myself. College, I changed all that when I kind of saw what people at the top levels were doing. And each year, I kind of decided I was going to do a little better, you know. I wanted to be in aqua finals, then I wanted to be in quarterfinals. Then it got to the point where I wasn't happy with that. I wanted to qualify for every round robin in the country. And I wanted to have a speaker award in every single tournament I went to. And I eventually wanted to win nationals. And all of that's within your grasp. It just depends on how hard you're willing to work towards it. Everyone in this room is smart enough to accomplish any of these goals.
Okay, now, question from the audience. Yeah, go ahead.
Astral projection or just specifically? The question was, how do we get into that zone specifically, and how do you astrally project? Next seminar on astral projection, this time, debate psychology. How do you get into it? Well, I think that there is I have a top 10 winning lecture, which I'll allude to in a few points, but I'll just give you the first two. The real essence of it is having confidence in yourself. I was talking with Glenn a couple days ago. He referred to this as conquering your fear is one method of describing that. But it's difficult because it's the most important step, but it's also the most kind of amorphous step. You know, confidence is a pretty vague concept. How do you get self-confidence? How do you feel fit in yourself? But the second step is the key to the first step. And the second step is preparation. And if you know, if you mentally dominate the round from the minute that the pairing goes up on the wall until the last card is asked for after the round and read by the judge and then she signs the ballot, if you mentally dominate that entire 2.5 hour experience, that's one good step toward preparation. There's a lot of stuff that comes before the round and a lot of stuff that comes after, but just focus on the round itself. Know your blocks, know your partner, know your opponents, know your judge, know your flows, know your pins, know your clock, know the room, know everything. And then within all of that knowledge, know the specific arguments. Within the specific arguments, know which cards weigh out which size. Know which cards have a little extra vivid color to them. There's a lot of aspects to it, but intimately being prepared will automatically translate into confidence. And confidence will automatically translate into the zone. Another cheesy Jordan quote, be the ball. Be every aspect of the ball.
Right up there.
I think we've all faced the other team who's walking in. You really can't see what they look like because they've got that tower of boxes in front of them.
Okay, at that point, you've really got to start making fun of these people, right? Like, what is possibly in those boxes you two don't cut cars? I can't imagine what you're toting around, right? Is that packed with your D-dub back file? And I promise you, that's all those things are. It's not like they've done 7 hubs worth of topic research, okay? If you get that, just, if y'all want it, everyone in this room can go back to their squad room and find 7, 8, 9 hubs worth of shit, I'm sorry, stuff to tote around, right? But we're not going to do that because it's obnoxious. For one, we don't ever use it. It's just a hassle checking it through the airport. We've got to carry it around all weekend, right? The people who do this are the stupid people, right? We don't want to be like these people. It's not that we need to overcome our intimidation of them. It's that they need to, like, get a grip on or become secure with their abilities as a debater, and not think they have to have this pile of subs to intimidate someone else. That shouldn't intimidate you, right? That should just be something you're glad that you're not that person carrying that stuff around, right? You know, you don't need more than 4 subs on almost any given topic, I would think.
And I think Glenn alludes to a really important point, is that they're doing that because they don't have confidence in themselves. And you should capitalize on that. Believe in yourself. They don't believe in themselves. You're one up on them already. And if you let them, somebody who has no confidence in themselves, intimidate you, you need to really work on building up your own self-confidence in the activity.
I'm just going to take one of the
How can you flow better?
Exactly. I'll answer this. The question is, how do you learn to flow better? I could never flow. I never could. My hands, they just move slowly. And so I could never get everything. It was such a pain. How I dealt with that was, number one, I looked at my partner's flow. You know? Number two, it got to the point where I was just not flow. I mean, think about it. Clinton did that. Topicality, a lot of stuff on Kate, you already know what the argument is. The important part is not actually getting down on the sub-scales, but Clinton, go get the cards and look at them, you know? And then beyond that, it's just practice, you know? Go flow out rounds. Go flow rounds whenever you have the opportunity. Work on developing a comprehensive list of abbreviations and symbols. All the topic words, for example, you know, P for Cuba, NK North Korea, I for Iran, EE for constructive engagement, so that it becomes second nature. And then finally, I recommend focusing more on listening than writing. Because if you begin to write when you first hear a tag, you end up writing a bunch of stuff that's irrelevant. Listen to the tag, embargo, blah, 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 becomes equal starvation. You know they're talking about the embargo. You don't have to write Cuba, that's the case. You know? Mostly just work.
And there are specific skill things you can do to practice flowing. Like if somebody else on your team is doing speed drills, go flow them. If they're doing speech redos, go flow and cooperate with each other. There's little games you can play. Like there's the card game where somebody flips a card and says a card, and you have to write down every card in the deck as they flip through it really fast because it teaches you to get the symbols down and things like that. So there's specific skill training you can do. But I think Paul hit on the absolute most important thing is don't worry about every word. Every word they say is not important. Just get the main idea and you'll be fine.
That's a big problem a lot of people have with flowing initially, I think, is the issue of spacing. Anyone in here ever run out of room, right, or when you're trying to write someone else's answers or something like that? It's because we tend to flow things. Like, I see people sometimes flow dissent answers, and they'll be like, you know, a micron of space between each answer. There's no way that you're going to be able to allow the debate to grow. Because if I remember, I mean, debate, the 1AC is just kind of a starting point, but debate is almost like a living creature that grows from there. And it goes in all sorts of directions. And you need to make sure, since it's so important that we record most of it on the flows, that you leave enough space. But keep that in mind. You always want, like, this much space between every answer, especially on a dissent that you know that you know that you're going to go for. For example, if the 2AC puts out a lot of answers, space them if you know you're going to go for that dissent, because you're going to need that space to write in your 2MC answers.
Yeah, I would just add that, again, since this is a panel on winning, and since one of those early questions was cutthroat, how do you intimidate your opponent, the main thing that I would worry about with flowing is flow your argument. Make sure that your stuff, the stuff that you spend time in your speech making an argument about, and that you want to extend later in the rebuttal, and stuff that your partner says, because those are your arguments too, you get to extend those. Get that shit flowing. I mean, I've watched so many practice rounds where people are just not writing down what they're saying. They're just kind of reading their blocks when they're up there, and then maybe if they get a chance, they'll write it down later. No way. Those are your weapons. Those are the things that you win the debate with. Flow them, get them down, become wedded to them, fall in love with them, and then extend them in rebuttals and crush your opponents with them. If you miss some of your opponent's stuff, like Paul is saying, you shell, that's clear. But your arguments, why would you not flow your arguments?
Guy on the side, pre-flow your shells. Always pre-flow your shells. As you change your shells, change your pre-flows, update them all the time. Next question.
Yeah.
No, maybe,
I think it's important to figure out early on what your strengths and weaknesses are. Like, some people just can't argue a dipset to save their life. Some people can't argue critiques to save their lives on the negative. Some people much prefer big stick cases. Some people prefer the little cases that don't blame. And I think it's really important to figure out what your strengths are, what your argument styles are, and then go with those. You know, like people like Anjan Sani, who carried around the backpack that was in the final round of the NBT, you know, because he found what his strengths were. He was exceptionally good at arguing the critiques that he went for, and that's what he did. And so I think it's good to pick out what you're good at early on. Like when you're young, like when you're a freshman and sophomore, it's good to experiment so that you can not get stuck in a rut, but truly find out where your strengths are. But then find out, this is what I'm good at, and then work on making yourself, say, if you like Clinton, make yourself the best Clinton debater in the country. And then there are specific things you need to do that. You know, you always have to have your updates. You always need to make sure you know exactly what's going on in the world. If you're going to argue a critique, you need to have front lines to all the common answers, you know. And so I think it's really picking out what your strengths are and capitalizing on those and making yourself the best debater in that area. And then once you do that, you can work on spreading yourself out so that you can do the other things also. But focusing in on your strengths, I think, goes a long way to making you a better debater to where you want to be.
I think that you've already made the first step, which is realizing that there's area for improvement. I think that too many people are aware they could be a better debater, but they don't actively think about what they need to do to become better. I recommend even going so far and being as anal as keeping a journal, recording what it is that you're winning on, what it is that you're losing on, what issues you don't understand. It doesn't take that long after a round, and if you are able at some point to look back and say, you know, my rounds seem to be coming down to this particular issue. I keep losing on this particular issue. And then be proactive. Talk to your judges. Too many people after the round, their purpose of discussion with the judge is to convince the judge either that you voted for the wrong team or you voted for me the right team, in which case I really don't have anything to talk to you about. That does not help you get better at all. After rounds, you need to talk to critics about the position. Find out what they found persuasive, what arguments they liked in the round. Keep track of what the judges like. Figure out where in the round did you have a problem. If it's a recurring problem, ask the critic, what could I have done to improve myself on this issue? You have to be proactive if you're going to get better. You can't just show up in a debate tournament, debate every round, and think you're going to become a better debater. You have to actively try and determine what is it that I need to improve on, and then take steps to improve in that area.
And I think one of the best ways to do that was something that I didn't debate in high school, so I had a really long lot to overcome to get to where I did. And one of the things that we did was early on, we tape recorded every round we were in, and we listened to every round, because in that instance where, but I said it, the judge just didn't understand. Ooh, I guess I didn't say that after I listened to the tape. Or, you know, oh, God, I thought I sounded like crap this round. Well, I didn't sound so bad, this was good. And it helps you really pinpoint what Paul's talking about, what is exactly wrong with what you're doing, which I think is helpful. Painful, but it's helpful.
I want to expound a little bit on what Paul said about this journal, this notion of the journaling. It sounds kind of foreign to a lot of you, but I would even take it much farther than even Paul saying. I think that is your Bible during the school year. You need to keep a notebook with you, a spiral notebook.
It never should leave your backpack. And it's not just for things like, what have I been losing on, what have I been winning on, but it's for things like every single judge you come into contact with, whether it's in a debate round or not, it could be outside the round, hanging outside smoking cigarettes, you should be a sponge. You should be absorbing everything. You should overhear conversations and absorb all of that and write that in your journal. You should write sites in there. You should write preferences judges have, right? This is for your eyes only, okay? But it should just be full of every little bit of debate knowledge you could possibly gain. Like, so people don't understand that the social settings are one of the best times, like, to pick the brains of your judges. Because, you know, you're at a party, the tournament, and you're talking with a judge, or you're overhearing a judge, and they're saying what they think about this certain position. Next morning, first round, you get this critic. You know exactly what to do, right? And this has happened to me before. And it's really nice when it does, because that judge, you know, you know what their predispositions are. You know how they want to hear this argument explained. So I think that journal entry is essential, okay? You've got to carry a notebook. All right, and it's also for things like when you hear a new case, you write the plan text, solve the authors, you write all the structure of the case in it. You keep track of everything that happens to you throughout the year in this journal. The second thing I want to mention, though, and this is back to Stephen's question, is I think the number one blockade, and Mark mentioned this earlier, the number one obstacle to people succeeding is their intimidation and their fear of other teams, okay? And even if you don't want to admit, oh, I'm not scared of anyone in the country, I don't think anyone in here doesn't get nervous if they were hitting, let's say, like the defending NDC national champion or the defending season national champion, okay? You just get a little bit intimidated. You need to realize that these people are just human like you, and this was the biggest thing for me to turn a corner. I used to be scared shitless of debating some certain people, right? Like the top five teams in the country. It's like, oh my God, there's no way I can ever beat them. I'm just not that good. That's not true. I'm just as good as they are. The thing is that they spent a lot more time preparing than I did. When I started to play the catch-up game, things changed substantially, and I started to beat these teams. And I also needed to realize that they don't know everything. They just might know different things than I do. And there's no reason I can't learn what they do. And the thing, and I know things that they don't know, even if those might not matter in a debate round sometimes. You know? The point being, I'm still just as smart as these people. One of the awesome things about this activity is that any team in the country can beat any other team in the country on any given day of the year. Right? There's nothing's written that you will never, ever, ever beat this team. You can beat anyone. If you're smart enough to gain college, you're smart enough to beat anyone in the country, I think. So that's my two rants.
Yeah, just as a closer to this one, you can definitely do this. Like Jan was saying, she never debated in high school, right? If she's sitting on this panel right now. Check out that Gordon Mitchell that I teach with at Emory. He was top speaker at the NDT, did LT in high school, right? Jethro, who's at this tournament right now, he debated, I think, 2 years in college. That was it. He was one ballot away from the final round of CNET, if it wasn't for the time. So, I mean, first of all, you definitely can dominate these rounds. And then to get back to your original question, with what I've got right now, what can I do to get some tenacious winning, which I think is what your original question was, where I'm at right now, right? Know your arguments. Be like a dog, bang, and just sink your teeth into those arguments and don't let your opponent get away from them. Just the arguments you've got sitting right over here right now, you could win 90% of your rounds. You know them intimately and you use them well.
Know your evidence. A lot of people, somebody else is glad to read the assignment. You look at the index, don't look at the cards. Know your evidence. Read every piece of evidence in your tub, and you will win so many more rounds. Because somebody reads something, you're like, oh, I don't have answers to that, but oh, there's something in this file. I remember reading a card, and you'll win so many more rounds if you know your evidence. And then it dramatically increases your confidence and feeling of preparedness also.
BYU's. How does persuasive, the question is, does persuasive speaking style add to your edge in winning? And if so, how can you improve it?
I think it does. I think it's all about your presence in the round. If you're a person who walks into, and it's not just in your speaking style per se, but if you walk into the round and you look like you don't belong there, if you're acting intimidated, you're acting shy, you're acting scared, and it's a close round and the other team's acting really confident, chances are, in a close decision, the judge is going to default to the other team. just because they think they're winning. And the judge is going to feel subconsciously like, if you don't believe you're winning, why should I believe you're winning, you know? And they do probably consciously a little more work for the other team. And I don't know that it's necessarily persuasive speaking in the, you know, what we teach in public speaking class is persuasive speaking, but having your persona as feeling confident and exuding that you believe you're winning and you know your argument and you believe that you're right, I think does have an edge, especially give you an edge, especially in close debate. Very especially in close debate. It's important.
Let's stick with this one for a second. I don't know if you guys have debated against these debaters out there. Anybody seen that new Star Wars movie? There's all these robots that land on Naboo and they're fixing it over. So, do you ever get that feeling when you're watching one of those debaters, and I mean, they got up there in this room, but they got the clock like this, and they're ready to start their speech, right? They look like those damn robots on Naboo, right? Okay, so the solution for persuasiveness is be yourself, you know, find your own inner debater, show that to the judge. The judge desperately wants to meet, you know, Queen Amidala instead of one of those family. All right, that's the first thing. The second thing is a little less ethereal and a little more nuts and bolts. You've got 9 minutes. Honor those 9 minutes, okay? In the public speaking world, I'm also a speech teacher. We have this thing called primacy and recency, and I actually learned it in the trenches of debate. Primacy is the first thing you say, recency is the last thing you say. And so there are these things called intros. I highly recommend that every speech and debate has an intro. Okay. Maybe it's 5 seconds long, you know, maybe it's 15 seconds long, but you should definitely have something to put your package together. Start off by telling your judge what they're going to be voting on, and then launch into your, you know, slicing and dicing of the argument for 9 minutes. But treat that 9 minutes with respect. Treat it like a canvas.
Since I did debate in high school, I think that I probably have some insights into this. And seated debate, policy debate, NDT, whatever you want to call it, is very intimidating. And it's intimidating for a couple of reasons. The first one is that people speak really fast, and most of them aren't familiar with that, so that freaks them out. There's all this evidence and all this information on these things you've never heard of. And then there's all this jargon, you know, that we, as debaters, because it makes it easier for us to say T instead of topicality, you know, for time constraints or whatever, that it makes sense for people who are in the know to say those things. But it's very, very intimidating for people who haven't been involved in the activity before. And I think the most important thing that you can tell people when they're starting the activity, if you're trying to convince other people on your team that they should continue doing this, is that look past what all that jargon is. Look past the fact that you have all these people spouting a bunch of random stuff. Because in a lot of instances, that's all they're doing. They're throwing around a lot of jargon words. They probably don't know what they mean half the time. They have all this evidence. Probably haven't read half the cards in the file. You know, that's not everybody in the debate, obviously, the top level debaters, that's not true of, but a lot of the younger debaters, it's like, ooh, I've caught on a jargon word, performative contradiction, how many times can I say it in my speech? Do I know what it means? No, not at all. And so look past what all that is to say, okay, this is what they're doing, and take it out of this whole debate jargon mindset and say, this is what the argument is. This is what, because I know your program is Parley also, and so it's just, and it's very similar in a lot of ways in terms of this is the argument construct, answers the argument. And instead of early on focusing on making sure everybody knows all the jargon, you know, say these are what the arguments are. This is what you have to do to beat the argument, as opposed to this is all the debate lingo you have to do. This is one of the most intimidating things. Some other things you can do, I think, to help ease the transition is just like have to make up a cheat sheet of all the jargon words, you know, that you can give to people so that they have something that they can feel comfortable with. They say non-unique. What does that mean? you know, and just a little cheat sheet, I think, is helpful also. And I think there are things you can focus on to convince people that they ought to join the activity. Just things like the amount of research that you do can be overwhelming, but at the same time, it helps you in all your classes, because pretty much when I was in college, after I started debating, every paper I ever wrote was from a research assignment I had done at debate. So you can do double time with all this stuff. It really impresses your professor, you know, things like that. There are all other reasons to do it. But I think ultimately you need to get people over this intimidation factor at the beginning. And I think by kind of demystifying it, it's probably the first thing that you need to do. Because I remember the first time I saw a debate, I was so intimidated and so scared. But what are these people talking about? They're talking fast. They're saying all these words I've never heard before. And ultimately what it was is I knew what the arguments they were making were. I just didn't know all the jingle and everything that went along with it. And so I think if you can get past that, it would be a big help for some of your other teammates probably that you're concerned about. Thank you.